Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, still flying solo today, and I have a few reminders for you. First, be sure to go to mightyparenting.com and get your free email series on communicating with your teen. It'll kickstart changes in your communication, and as you do that, generally we find that you build a stronger relationship with your child as well. And if you're going, my kid's younger, my kid's older, great. If they're younger and you're starting earlier, that's even better. And if they're already in their 20s, they're off to college, or they're out in their own apartment, it's still the same premise. So go grab that and give yourself a little gift there. While you're there, pop on over to the support page, mightyparenting.com support, and see what we have for you there and how you can support us as well. And I also want to send out a big, huge thank you to those of you who are supporting us with one-time or monthly contributions. I know for a lot of you, you're like, this doesn't seem like much, but adding up those $2, $3, and $10 a month contributions makes a big difference in helping us keep Mighty Parenting on the air and focused on you. So big, huge thanks and hugs from Judy and myself for those of you who've done that. Today, we are talking about our kids getting into trouble. And I personally think this is a topic that's really easy to ignore or skip over or tune out, because you can't imagine your kid ever getting into trouble and getting to the point of it going to the legal system. And I totally get that. I sit here and I can't imagine that happening to my girls either. And I also know, if I'm perfectly honest, that if I wasn't out there looking out for our Mighty Parenting community and making sure I get all the info we think you guys need, even on the tough subjects, I wouldn't have sought out this information myself. But the truth is that we can all get touched by our kids getting into the legal system. I know parents, good parents, who got that horrible late-night phone call telling them that their kid was in jail. And you know that call, and it doesn't matter if your kid's the honor roll student, the pseudo-council president, the star athlete, the one with a zillion friends, the good kid, the troublemaker. It doesn't matter. It can happen, and it can happen when we don't expect it. I know Judy's son had an issue when he was around 10. This just wasn't a legal system issue, but it's a great view into how things can happen with our kids. So here's Jeffrey. He's about 10 years old, and they were at like a church or community center for Boy Scouts or whatever club he was in, and he trots off to go use the restroom, and he's not coming back, and he's not coming back, and then all of a sudden, he's coming back. But he's getting towed in by an adult, and this boy is in trouble. It turns out that when he got to the restroom, there were some other boys there who thought it was funny to clog the toilets and overflow them and flood the bathrooms. They got out before the adult showed up. They heard somebody coming, and they all ran. And Jeffrey, not being a troublemaker, didn't even know to run. So he's standing there. He gets caught, and he gets in trouble for it. And Judy's like, you know, I get you didn't do it, but you also stood around while someone else did it. So that was wrong too. And fortunately, this is a situation where it was a teaching moment and he had to clean up and he learned a huge lesson. But what happens when those situations are when our kids are older and the police get called in and suddenly we're in that situation? So that is why I thought it would be a good idea for all of us to get an inside look at what's really happening with our kids and what happens in the juvenile legal system, how our kids are getting into trouble, and what we can do to prevent that. So bringing us those insights today is Elvin Gonzalez. Elvin is the Family Division Administrator for the Berrien County Trial Court. He has over 33 years of experience in the juvenile justice field, so he definitely knows what he's talking about. He's worked in detention facilities, residential treatments, intensive probation programs, and management of probation and court services departments in both Illinois and Michigan. He has been a progressive leader in organizational change in the juvenile justice field. He's championed best practices based on the what works evidence-based principles and data-driven decision-making. So he's aware of what we can do that actually helps our kids and what doesn't. And he is incredibly passionate about serving families and helping our kids. And he's joining us today to help us get a little insight and a little understanding that we need as parents. So Alvin, thank you so much for joining the Mighty Parenting community today.
My pleasure. I look forward to hopefully provide information that the parents will find useful, practical, and give them a good start on dealing with difficult issues with their kids.
Yeah, because like I said, you know, we all want to think that our kids won't get into trouble, won't be a behavior problem, won't do something wrong. And sometimes we think that they're not and they are, and sometimes we see that happening. So let's maybe start out and maybe you can share with us, what are kind of some of the most common things our kids do that can actually get them into legal trouble?
Well, some of the common things that kids do, and this is something that we see reflected in juvenile courts throughout the country. Typically, when kids are getting in trouble, they get in trouble with other kids. It's typically not alone. And the kinds of things we see kids getting in trouble for involves things like shoplifting, drug or alcohol use, getting involved in, now with the real involvement of social media in their lives. Kids are very wired, very connected into social media. Kids will get on social media, and because they're not fully mature in their judgment and their decision making, they'll make really dumb decisions when they're using cell phones, laptops, webcams, and that brings them to the attention of the court or the police.
So it's them taking pictures of themselves, well, making bad choices,
sure,
that's actually getting them in trouble?
Sure. So a lot of kids don't know that if you are using any kind of electronic device and you send a picture of your body or the body of another person, particularly their private areas, their genitals or other areas, that it's a crime because it's illegal to transmit graphic images using any electronic device. And so those types of things can happen. We actually have seen that happen as early as late elementary and junior high school is where it really we've seen a kind of a spike in that type of behavior. The other thing is that kids will use social media to post messages, information, which could go from bullying behavior, as we call it, cyberbullying, using technology to harass, intimidate, threaten, make fun of another individual, to more serious behaviors where it involves things like making threats against schools, threatening to hurt people at a school, bring explosives to school, and in some cases, more intentional, planful criminal behavior of using technology to sell drugs, look for drugs, obtain drugs, exchange drugs, sell drugs, and they'll use chats, various chat apps to make those connections with other kids. And it could be kids that live next door or kids that live completely across town, but because the accessibility, pretty much the 24/7 accessibility of those technologies, the fact that every kid in America, probably between the ages of, I'd say, at least 13 and on up, has access to those devices, it's very handy. And it can be used for good, but again, some kids are using those technologies for wrong purposes.
Yeah, so that was an interesting thing that you touched on, which was actually one of the questions I'd had was, you mentioned the idea that, you know, kids are sending inappropriate pictures of themselves or mm-hmm. other people mm-hmm. and don't realize it's a crime. Mm-hmm. Are there other behaviors that you see them doing that they don't understand that it's a crime? They're just thinking, well, this is my life and it's what I choose to mm-hmm. do. I'm not hurting anybody. And
mm-hmm. Yeah, clearly the social media use behaviors that I described are definitely things that kids are unaware that are crime. Some kids think that, well, I'm just saying these words, so what's the big deal? I threatened to beat somebody up, or I was just joking, and I didn't know that by making that statement on the internet that, you know, the FBI could show up at my house or law enforcement could show up at my house. So when kids are making statements about hurting other individuals, they may characterize it, I was just mad, I was just blowing off some steam, I don't like that person, but they don't understand how because of the way they're sharing or communicating that information, it crosses over to that legal barrier, that legal threshold, and it becomes a criminal offense. And in some cases, it can be a felony offense, which is this very serious offense. And in certain types of behavior done online, can actually be considered a federal offense. If you threaten government institutions, federal government organizations, presidents, that's a federal offense. And you'll have more than just the police showing up at your door. And so those are some of the things. I think the other piece is with the change in the laws in the United States now, here, particularly in the Midwest, there is, as you may be aware, there's been the adopting of new laws that make recreational marijuana use legal, but they only make it legal if you're 21 and over. If you're under the age of 21, it's still illegal to possess, to consume, to use. And so kids think, well, hey, you know, my mom and dad or my grandma has got medical marijuana or recreational marijuana, so what's the big deal? And kids are getting arrested because they are having the marijuana on their possession, they're in public smoking it, they're using it, and they don't think it's a crime because mom and dad or grandma or uncle, whoever is doing it. That's an area that we have seen, and we'll probably see more of that as recreational marijuana gets passed into law in more and more states. And the other one that we're, the other type of behavior that we see is, kids don't understand that if you go across state lines and you bring, say, drugs back in from one state back into your home state, you are crossing state lines with drugs and you could get yourself in trouble with trafficking. And that's a concern. Kids don't understand that that's a big deal.
Yeah, so a couple of things in there. I mean, of course, in our area, listeners, Elvin of Bering County is where I live. We are in the very southwest corner of Michigan, so we are very close to a state line border. Mm-hmm. We're right at Indiana, and I can absolutely see kids, as you said, not realizing that marijuana use is only 21 and up, which I'm going to go back to in a second, mm-hmm. and then just popping over the border because they're going to a party or they're going to a friend's house or they're mm-hmm. just, this is what we do. We just pop mm-hmm. over the border because that's where I go to do my basic shopping and things. That's mm-hmm. the closest mm-hmm. city, really. So mm-hmm. that's an interesting one. And I want to go back to the marijuana for a minute. Mm-hmm. As you were talking about it, I was thinking about it, and I realized that as a parent with young 20-something children, mm-hmm. I haven't actually discussed this with them because it's not something that our family does, that mm-hmm. you know, their behavior is what they say. What I see leads me to believe that they wouldn't be interested, but I don't know that for sure. Mm-hmm. They certainly mm-hmm. wouldn't be racing up to me going, "Hey mom, marijuana is legal. I'm going to try some." And yep. so I'm thinking that, you know, as parents, we haven't had the same conversations with them about this that we have about alcohol or what we consider mm-hmm. street drugs. Because it's new and it sure. just, I don't know, there's something different about the marijuana piece to mm-hmm. the drug and alcohol scene that there are some oddities. So that's definitely a conversation we all need to be having with our kids is, hey, even if you are someplace that it's legal, you have to be 21. If you cross mm-hmm. state, you know, if you do something when you're underage or you're with people who are mm-hmm. underage, and you cross state lines, you have now committed a trafficking drugs crime, mm-hmm. which that what becomes federal? Is that what happens there?
It's going to depend on the quantity of the drugs that an individual has, but I think you hit on a good point here. The conversations with our kids about things like responsible social media use, the impact of using, being with friends who use, because frequently when you ask a kid, or you know, when parents ask a kid, you know, are you using? They'll say, no, I don't use. But then the next question they forget to ask is, do any of your friends use? And then you find out, oh yeah, I've got three friends that use. Well, kids hang out in groups typically, or hang out with other kids, and so when your kid tells you he doesn't use or he or she doesn't use, but their friends use, well, there's increased odds that your kid is going to at least experiment or use. The other thing with marijuana, the marijuana that is available now to kids is a different potency level than marijuana that was available in the 60s and 70s. It's been evaluated to be anywhere from, so say the percentage of THC, which is the chemical in the marijuana that gives you the high effect. Back in the 60s and 70s, the percentage of THC in the marijuana was anywhere between, 6 to 12% THC. Now you can purchase marijuana that is higher than 25% THC content, which is a stronger, more potent THC. They're also seeing that scientists are seeing that chronic marijuana users, that chronic use of high potency marijuana can exacerbate existing mental health issues that kids may have, or really create real negative effects such as hyper paranoia. And if somebody is already predisposed to that because of their own mental health issues, it can worsen that. And so there's this whole belief that, well, the marijuana that we're using today is the same marijuana that my parents used back in the 60s and 70s, and that's not the case. It's physically more potent. There's just a lot more effects. And there's a number of articles that have come out recently talking about that. The key thing, though, I think the conversations with your kids should be ongoing conversations that are what I call proactive conversations. It's always kind of, you're forced into a conversation when the police knock at your door and say, hey, my kid's been arrested for this, or your kids, we've just arrested your kid for this and this behavior. You're going to have conversations because it's in your face. It's there. You got to deal with it. But my advice to parents is talk about the things that are going on related to recreational marijuana or other types of behaviors when they're younger. And it could be a conversation where you say, what do you think about this? What do you think a young person, what do you think you would do if you were in a situation and this happened, and give them what if scenarios, what would you suggest to your friend if your friend came to you and said they were thinking about using this drug, and what would you say to them? And that actually opens up a lot of insight into the way they think about those behaviors, what their own decision-making process or thought process would be about it. And it opens the dialogue so that when they do get into those risk situations, you've had those conversations and you've at least put options on the table for choices that they can select from and hopefully make better choices if they find themselves in those circumstances.
Well, it gives them a chance to think it through ahead of time. I like that you said, you're giving them some choices to select from, some good mm-hmm. choices. Mm-hmm. I think the follow-up piece to that is maybe giving them a life raft out. So mm-hmm. the conversation also of, okay, you're out with people who are going to do something that you're not okay with. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do about that? How can you get out of that?
Sure, that's a great suggestion. And there's a lot of different ways that parents have used actually technology to help their kids kind of phone a friend, so to speak. And so there's been parents who've used the cell phone connection with their kid, and the kid's in a circumstance or situation where they don't feel comfortable, they hit a button, it auto-dials their parent, and it gives them a code, and that basically means, come get me. I don't want to be here, come get me. And so part of this is we all understand as parents, we are not going to be able to be with our kids 24/7. That's not just the way it is. They, especially at preteen years of age, I would say right around 11, 12, 13, we become less important in our kids' lives because their friends are most important. And that just ramps up when they get into their teenage years. They will listen to their teens more likely than they're going to listen to a parent. And they're going to spend more time away from us, and we can't control those circumstances. What we can do is arm them with factual, accurate knowledge and information, talk with them and help them develop the kinds of decision-making and assessment and decision-making skills that they need, and then giving them some real good arrows, what I call arrows in their quiver, that they can use should they find themselves in a situation where, A, they don't feel comfortable, they don't feel safe, they're nervous about what's going on. And I use those conversations with kids to say, how do you feel when you're with some friends and somebody's drinking and they're driving kind of crazy? And they'll say, I feel nervous. And then we'll talk about, why do you feel nervous? Well, because I'm worried that we're going to get arrested or the car's going to crash. And I said, that's your early warning indicator that you're not in a good space, you're not in a good place. So again, teaching kids, equipping kids with knowledge, information, decision-making skills so they can manage some of those challenging circumstances they're going to find themselves in or prevent themselves from getting into those.
And what I hear you saying, Alvin, is I don't hear you saying, go in and tell your kids, do this, don't do that. You can't hear, you can't go here. You can't hang out with these people. Everything mm-hmm. I've heard you say is ask them questions, share mm-hmm. facts with them, mm-hmm. share good, solid, reputable sources of information with them. Mm-hmm. But this isn't about just us trying to impose our opinion on them. It's saying, hey, stuff happens. And I want to make sure that you are able to make good decisions for you.
That's exactly my point. That's really well stated. It is about empowering kids with the ability to use good decision making to be able to assess situations, because we're not going to be able to be with them all the time. And the other thing we want to do is make it okay for our kids to know if you make a mistake. I mean, you're a kid. You're learning from that. You're going to make some mistakes. It's okay to come and talk to me about that and say, hey, I was with some friends and this happened and I don't know. I don't think I made the right decision, and not punish your kid over harshly, because they, you know, that's fantastic if your kid comes to you and says, hey, I want to tell you about this, or you discover something and you approach them and then they disclose. You want to reinforce that openness with your kid and say, you know, I understand it's a tough situation to be in and it was a hard decision for you to make. What would you do differently next time? And then use that opportunity to build on future success.
So as a parent, if, because I want to walk this line of, as you said, they come to you, you want to encourage that open communication, that open conversation. And we need to balance that with making sure our kids experience consequences for actions. Mm-hmm. So let me see mm-hmm. if I've got this one right. What I'm hearing is, if they come to me to talk to me about a situation they were in or something they did not harm anybody else, that did not create a scenario where they really need to be making restitution to somebody for something, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. then because they approached me to go, hey, this is what happened, it makes sense to just have the conversation with them. If they've created a situation where they've caused harm, they've destroyed something, they need to make some sort of restitution, then it would be a conversation paired with, I get it, and you're learning and you made a mistake, and part of that is that you made this happen, how can you make it right?
Correct. You're not letting them off the hook. I mean, this is just not about having a conversation and then not having any personal accountability, because they ultimately, kids benefit from assuming and being given the personal responsibility and accountability for their decisions. So if you're not letting them off the hook, if your kid goes out and makes a poor decision, you know, we can all agree it's and they can probably agree it was a dumb decision. There were consequences that came out of that. Some, you know, things were damaged or this, you know, if somebody got arrested or whatever. But then how do we use that opportunity to say, okay, how are we going to fix this? What are you going to do to make this right? And it may be restitution. It may be you don't get to drive the vehicle for X period of time. And one of the things that we find is that when you give kids an opportunity to give input on what the consequences should be, not that you that you don't have your, not that you don't use your authority as a parent, but you give them involvement in determining the consequence, A, they tend to be tougher on themselves than parents are, and B, when you come up with a consequence together, they tend to be more likely to follow that consequence rather than you just imposing one. And so it may be that they lose the use of their cell phone or the use of a vehicle, or they have a loss of a privilege with a time frame. So it's not forever and ever and ever and ever. They don't have this anymore, but kids like specifics. They like time frames. They like certainty. They like to know that there is a chance that this they can regain a privilege or that they've lost. And so I've always encouraged parents that if you're going to determine a consequence with your child for a behavior, that you discuss those things. How long is this consequence in place? What does it look like when I'm following through with my consequence? And what's the privilege I get restored once I've shown compliance? That's very helpful. It gives kids a sense that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. They can redeem themselves, so to speak, and learn from that experience.
I can also see a part of this conversation being, hey, this happened, and yes, there is this consequence, but I also want you to know that you've increased my trust in you, and I see that you are acting much more adult, and I appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, the key thing is distinguish the behavior from the kid. You know, so if your kid does something, that's a behavior that they it's a series of choices and behaviors that they engaged in that were not responsible or maybe not mature. But it doesn't mean that they're a bad kid. It doesn't mean that they're a bad person. The behavior is separate from the identity of your child and the value of your child. And so you want to make sure that you address the behavior, maybe the decision making that led to that behavior, and still give your kid the message, you know, I still care and love you. I don't like what you did, but I love you. And as a good parent, I'm going to talk with you, and we're going to discuss this, and we're going to come up with a consequence, and it doesn't break my bond and my connection to you as a kid. You're still my kid. You did a dumb thing. We're going to work together. You're going to make this right, and we're still going to be okay. And I think sometimes kids need to hear that there is accountability from their parents. They like that. There's a sense of structure and predictability. And they also like to understand that with that accountability, there is forgiveness and there is no damage of the relationship that you have with your kid. The relationship exists. That's there regardless of what happens. But they definitely appreciate the accountability. Kids don't like to be, and as much as they protest against this, and they will tell you this very, very loudly, you know, you're such a mean parent, and, you know, so-and-so's, my friend's parents don't do this. Well, guess what? You know, you're raising your kid. You want to do it the best way that you know how. Getting informed as a parent, making good decisions, and being consistent in your discipline. So your kid knows, hey, if I do these things, this is what's going to happen. I encourage parents to talk with their kids in advance and say, okay, for example, you've just gotten your driver's license. You've got your license. You're excited to go out there and drive. So not only do you want to talk with your kid about what does it mean to be a responsible driver and what does that look like and how will that be when they're behind the wheel, but I think you should also talk with your kid what will happen if they choose to not drive responsibly. In advance, not before there's a big issue, but in advance, and have your kid have that conversation with your kid and say, okay, here's what the rules of the road are. Here's our expectations. Here's what we've agreed that you'll do when you're driving this vehicle. And here's what we've agreed will happen if you choose to make immature or irresponsible decisions when you're driving the vehicle. And here's the potential consequences. And then the kid's clear. You know, you've got a very clear, here's the good, and here's the consequences if you don't drive responsibly. So that if and when there should be a circumstance that you guys are having to talk about, it won't be a surprise that you're going to have the consequences will be in place.
Yeah, and I can see that being kind of a general conversation. We don't have to say, if you do this, this is what happens. If you get a speeding ticket, you will this. If you get an accident, you will this. It can be kind of a general, hey, if you're not a responsible driver, one, you're going to have to make the restitution. So you're going to deal with the financial consequences. Mm-hmm. You will lose driving privileges for some period of time, depending on what the infraction was. It's kind of sort of a overarching thing, not trying to create a, I always feel like when, you know, when the kids are little and I first heard someone talking about, you know, making choice, you know, telling them this is what will happen. And it's like, well, in some cases I feel like I'm going, well, here are your two choices. Like, and I get that it's still two choices, but it was kind of like, geez, you know, is it worth getting sent to my room for the afternoon to be able to do this right now, as opposed to instilling our values and things in them? And
sure.
I think in this case, like you've said, with these proactive conversations and going, hey, when you do something, you have to be responsible for it. You'll have to make restitution, and you're going to lose some privileges.
Yep, Exactly. It's a lot easier as a parent to have these conversations when you are calm and you are not stressed out dealing with a crisis event, because you have the ability to kind of talk it through with your kid. And it might be it's not just one conversation. It might be a series of conversations over a time frame where you talk about it, and you're better prepared if and when you have to face a crisis or face a circumstance to say, okay, We've laid some ground here. We've plowed some ground over this area. We're ready now to we're going to have to talk about what's just happened. And kids are, and we all know this, kids have a whole life that they live with us, but they have a whole life they live outside of our house. And we hope to stay informed and be aware and pay attention to know what that life is that they live outside of our homes. But they have a whole set of friends and a whole set of peers that they associate with that that we don't always know what they're doing. And you won't know. And it's practically impossible to know. But you start looking for certain patterns of behavior and you reinforce the things that are positive and good and show responsibility. And you address the things that are like the indicators that they're not being responsible. So kids love to test limits. So if you say, here's the line, don't cross the line, any average teenager will put their foot on that line and to see what you're going to do with it. And they'll step over that line and see what you're going to do. That's just being a teen. That's just what they do. And so what our challenge is not to get reactive to that, but just stay emotionally neutral and calm. And remind the kid of the line that you've drawn, and if necessary, you know, impose a consequence. And one of the most challenging things to do as a parent is to make rational decisions when you're not feeling rational, when you're highly upset. And so I encourage parents sometimes to use this thing called the 24-hour rule. If you just found out some information about your kid that just makes you really upset, that's probably not the best time to make a decision on how you want to handle that. Give yourself an hour or two, give yourself a break, talk to a friend, regain emotional control, and then engage your kid in the conversation. That's important.
Yeah. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Because sometimes when we're making decisions, especially if we're in the heat of the moment, we tend to make these really outlandish statements or we have these consequences that we want to impose that are really draconian. And we go, oh, wow, that now that I've had 24 hours or whatever period of time to think about this, I was kind of over the top. And so I think we make better decisions as people when we are able to make rational decisions, weigh out, you know, the specifics of the event that's occurred, take into account the unique circumstances. And then maybe we have several kids and this is a particular kid that makes these kinds of decisions and we need to understand that. And then we make, I think, wiser decisions as parents.
This conversation about consequences and responsibility reminds me of one of the talks I heard where you talked about you were talking about the top three risk factors for a child ending up in prison. And the number mm-hmm. one was attitude. But you explained mm-hmm. that it's not what we commonly think of as a bad attitude. So could you explain what that attitude is that predisposes our kids to end up in jail?
Sure. So a couple things. In the juvenile justice field, there's been a lot of advancement in the use of risk and needs assessments. And risk need assessments are tools and assessments developed to evaluate the various factors that put kids at risk of future delinquency. So it's not like risk for dropping out of school. It's risk for delinquency, for engaging in delinquent or criminal conduct. And so there's a category called attitudes, but it's not like the bad attitude. It's really attitude is comprised of three elements. What are your values? What are your beliefs? And what are your thoughts? So what's your value system? What are your beliefs about people, about the world, about how you make your choices? So it really goes into your thought processes. And we gain and learn, and we some of our attitudes, values, and beliefs we get from watching others that are close in our life. So we look at how our parents make decisions and how our parents deal with honesty in their relationships with others. We look at what our friends do. So attitude, values, and beliefs, those are the things that are comprised under that scale. And so sometimes when you're interviewing a kid in the juvenile justice field and we're doing this assessment process and we'll ask a kid, so tell me why you did this behavior. And the kid will say things like, well, you know, that lady left her purse in the car and she was stupid for doing that. So just too bad for her. Well, that's an antisocial attitude, value, and belief right there, because it's basically blaming the victim for you stealing their purse. Like if you'd been smart, you would have hid your purse. that's not a pro-social belief system. Or somebody says, well, you know, we talk to a kid and we're asking them about shoplifting from a store, and they'll say, well, you know, they've got more of those items in the store. That's no big deal. You know, stores are always trying to rip people off with these high prices. So if I steal some from them, that's a delinquent attitude right there. It doesn't show remorse, doesn't show any personal responsibility. It's blaming a factor outside of themselves for their own conduct. So that's what we mean by attitude. And you know, teenagers, by and large, go through the stage where they like to complain, and they like to talk about how things aren't fair in the world and all that. And that's a typical stage of pre-adolescence and adolescence. And that's not what we're talking about when we're talking about attitudes. Attitudes are those values and belief systems that are really pro-delinquent and kind of against the norms of our society.
So that's, I think, where some of this talking to them about their responsibility, their need to make amends if they've mm-hmm. caused harm to people, show them mm-hmm. that there are consequences, that they aren't above the rules, they aren't above the law, that mm-hmm. everybody has these social responsibilities.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And there's a number of really, really good ways to teach, because kids tend to be pretty narcissistic. They tend to focus on themselves. What do I like? What do I want? And they get their wants and needs, confused. They think they need all these things, but they don't really need all those things. It's what they want. But an effective way to help kids understand like the impact of their behavior is to really, so I use examples where I'll say to a kid, how would you feel if somebody stole your brother's bike, took your brother's bike? Or how would you feel if somebody did this behavior to your grandmother? How would you feel if you came home and somebody had broken in your house and stolen your TV? And it kind of takes them outside of themselves. And it also helps them see that behavior impacts people. It's not just you did a behavior, it impacted somebody else. And because they tend to be narcissistic, they tend to only think of themselves. And so using examples where you use a friend as an example, a family member that they're close to, that they have a good relationship with as an example, if that happened to them, how would you feel? And that begins the conversation. Because typically kids will say, oh, I'd be mad if they did that. And I say, well, why would you be mad? It's no big deal. And they go, no, it is a big deal. And then they start to argue the point that you would want to make as a parent, that, yeah, it is a big deal when you steal from somebody. It is a big deal if you hurt somebody else. And then that draws them into the conversation about, well, let's talk about, if you see how you're reacting to the situation that you're hearing about your friends or your family being victimized, this is why it's important that you not do this behavior, because that's how your victim felt when you did this. So that's one technique that we've used. And I think the other piece to this is we have used a variety of what we call restorative justice methods to help kids understand the impact of their behavior on others. And that's where they actually have an opportunity to sit across the table in a very structured and facilitated process and see and actually meet the victim that they victimized. And it's done in a very structured and therapeutic way. And they get to hear from the victim how their behavior impacted them. And it's sometimes for kids, it's the first time that they've actually ever had to have that type of interaction and face that accountability. It's a very powerful process. It's called restorative justice. There's a variety of methods that in ways that can be done. And many courts and juvenile probation departments and even community agencies are adopting these restorative justice practices.
As we're having this conversation, I'm liking these words, restoration and justice, in talking to our kids, because as you said, it's taking the consequences of their behavior outside of just their world. It's not just, oh, I did something and I'm getting punished by mom and dad. Mm-hmm. It's, I did something, I caused this harm. Mm-hmm. How do I make up for this harm? And I think that is a lesson that as parents we can teach. And I'm sure that in your profession, you would love if we moved that all upstream so you don't have so much of it to do yourself there. Mm-hmm. Back at the beginning of the conversation, when I asked you what the most common things were. And some of the things you talked about were, you know, cyberbullying, well, just bullying, but you were talking about in terms of cyber, you know, threats against people and things. Are those issues just when they happen online, or are you seeing those as becoming issues that are getting bumped up to the legal system through schools and the expansion of the zero tolerance policies and that type of thing?
Well, we've looked at, in the juvenile justice field, they've looked at juvenile crime patterns. I mean, going back, you know, multiple decades, and there's pretty significant consistency of about the types of behavior that the average teen gets involved in over time. And this is irregardless of geographic area, regardless of socioeconomic or racial background of the kids. And it's there are three kind of main categories of behavior. And the one category is retail, you know, theft, retail fraud, stealing from somebody else. That's a pretty consistent pattern over decades of juvenile crime, whether they steal from a store, steal from a neighbor's garage. So the theft-related behavior. The other behavior is, you know, we call assault and battery, but it's more the fight. Two kids get angry at each other and they're fighting, or some kid gets upset at their parent and there's a domestic violence situation that happens. That's a pretty consistent behavior among children over time. It's usually when conflict that escalates in a household, and whether it's a difficulty they have in resolving or de-escalating that conflict, it does escalate and they push and shove. And that happens, and that's a pretty consistent teen behavior over time. So theft-related behavior, assault and battery, like domestic violence kinds of things, and then what we call the alcohol and drug category. So that's the marijuana, you know, and alcohol use kinds of behaviors. Those are actually probably the three most consistent types of adolescent behaviors that juvenile courts deal with. In fact, over the last 15 years, there's been a rapid reduction in what we call the violent crime categories across the nation. That's been a real drop in juvenile crime over the years. But those three behaviors I mentioned earlier, those are the three most common trends that persist over time. And some of those are a function of the stage of life that those kids are in. You know, as most teens want to, you know, they want to run their lives before they're actually cognitively and from the brain science research, we know they're not fully mature yet, and they think they know better than a parent. So there's conflict in the home over that. And then most shoplifting occurs in peer situations where you go with a friend, or you're at least with one other friend, and you're involved in shoplifting. And that's that kind of immediate need, immediate gratification impulse of teens. And then of course the social, recreational settings where kids get together and they want to, quote, party. So again, those are the three behaviors over time that we see.
Do you see an increase in kids being brought into the legal system for these things? I have no data on this. You do, but it feels like I hear more stories about kids actually getting charged for things that when I was a kid were handled in the school, in the home, with mm-hmm. between the parent and the neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we don't see necessarily a huge spike, in Michigan. So Berrien County, as you know, is in Michigan, and there has been a reduction overall in those types of behaviors over time. So they, even while they make up the most, the highest volume of cases that we see, overall there's been a reduction over time. And this has been something that's been very interesting among, you know, the sociologists and criminologists and so on, there's a grain of the American population. There are, you know, folks are getting older. The birth rate is dropping in the United States, but we're not seeing a huge influx. In fact, in our county, there's been a 40% reduction in the number of kids coming into the court system in the last almost 20 years now. 40% reduction. So less kids coming into the system. They're still coming in for the what we call the usual customary types of behavior, but there's been an overall reduction of kids coming into the system. And in part, that has been because of a variety of reasons, you know, where there's more effective early intervention programs that are happening in communities. There's more of awareness of mental health issues with kids. You know, there is more, our goal is to have more safety nets in the community in schools, equip parents and families with resources early on so they don't have to have their kid end up in the juvenile justice system. And my goal is to have less kids come into the juvenile system, not more. So I think those communities who really do a good job of supporting and investing in early intervention, early prevention services, they see the benefit of that. There's less kids dropping out, less kids coming into the system. And my belief is that there's really two key safety nets in the community that support kids. The primary one, of course, is a family, a healthy, functional family, however that family is defined or constructed. But a healthy, functional family is key to keeping kids out of the juvenile justice system. The second huge safety net is a healthy, vibrant, engaged educational environment for a kid to go to. I tell parents, you know, you have a job and you go to your job every day, or you do some type of work or vocation, and that's where you demonstrate mastery and competence. And for kids, it's school. School is their job. If we help kids be successful in school, having good grades, good attendance, good positive connections, that's a huge buffer against delinquency in their adolescence and, you know, late adolescence. And so those communities that really support parents, those communities that really have strong, vibrant schools, we tend to see less delinquency.
That's actually so wonderful to hear. I was not aware of that, and that makes me feel really good. And so my last question for you, Alvin, is, you know, we've done what we can here, but we get that phone call that no parent wants, telling us our kid is at the police station. What's the best course of action for a parent to take at that point?
Well, if your child has been arrested, and the fact that police are calling you, you definitely want to get the facts, because your child will tell you one version of what occurred, and that's their version. But being able to speak to the adults that took your child into custody and understand what occurred as factually as you're able to get that information, that's helpful. It's also important to, once you've obtained the facts, determine what's the next steps. If your child's arrested, it may be they brought them down to the station, they're going to ticket your child, and then they have to go to court for a future date. So getting the facts from your child and getting, hearing their version and giving them a chance to tell you what happened, and then, of course, getting the facts from the adults that took your child into custody, that's helpful as well. And then if your child is going to have to come to court, I think it's important to kind of prepare yourself, because going to the court process is challenging. They speak a whole different language there. It's called legalese. It's probably advisable to consult with an attorney with your child to say, okay, what are we facing here? What are things we need to do? Clearly, as parents, deciding what will be the parental consequence that your child will have to abide by, because the legal process takes a bit longer to wind its way through. But I always tell parents, if your kid gets in trouble, nothing takes away your right to impose a parental consequence. They might have a legal consequence they have to deal with, or if it's a school-related behavior, they might have an educational consequence that they'll have to deal with, in addition to whatever parental consequence you impose. So you want to make sure that whatever that behavior was, you understand it from their perspective, from the authority's perspective, determine if there's a parental consequence that you need to impose. If your child is going to go into the legal system, have an opportunity to consult with a family law or a juvenile law attorney so you understand what you're facing, particularly if you get a notice to come to court. And most attorneys will in fact, every attorney that I'm aware of, and it's kind of by the practice of law, they offer free consultation, one free consultation, so you can bring the paperwork in and sit down with them, and they can explain, this is what this is, this is what this is most likely going to look like when you go to court. And then, you know, be there with your kid. Show, you know, if you have to come to court with your kid, go to court, ask questions, get the name of the staff or the probation, like if your son gets involved or daughter gets involved with the juvenile court, communicate with a probation officer, form a team to support your child getting back on the right path. And you have a right to ask questions, you have a right to be fully informed of what's going on, and use that opportunity to, again, form that team with your child to say, okay, you made a bad decision, you made a poor decision, we're going to get you back on the right track, you're part of this, so we'll be in it with you. And I think that's kind of the real basic fundamental things you need to do as a parent.
Okay. So we're going to kind of sum up our conversation here and go, hey, we need to talk with our kids. We need to continue having at Mighty Parenting. We talk about all these conversations we need to have, folks. So here are more conversations. Talk to your kids about things that they might not realize are a crime, like sending pictures of people's bodies, putting threats or bullying messages or buy, sell, trading drugs on any electronic device. Things that they say when they say, I'm just joking, that marijuana is only legal for people over 21. And if you use it under that, one, you're breaking the law. And two, if you cross state lines, you can create much larger issues for yourself. And we need to make sure that we are continuing to not only talk to our kids, but to help them learn and grow. So hold them accountable for things that they do. And also talk to them about how they would feel and what they can do in various situations, and give them that code word, that safety net to pull them out of a bad situation. If they call, text, you know, set up that safe word for texting or however you want to do that. And hopefully none of us will ever experience this, but if you get that phone call from the police, get the facts. Make sure you understand the next steps in the legal system. If you're going to be going to court, consult with a family lawyer or a juvenile lawyer. And I know, Elvin, in one of the links that you sent us, I was going through there, and they very specifically said, parents, do not try to represent your child in court. Keep your mouth shut. Don't, even at the police station, if they're going to be questioned about something, get them an attorney. Don't jump in yourself, because what you want to do as a parent and what needs to happen in the legal system are very different things, and we can get our kids into trouble. And then don't forget that there's still a parental consequence. And Elvin, I just mentioned, you know, you were very generous. You sent several links. So what I'm going to do, rather than trying to give those long links out here, is they will be in the show notes at mightyparenting.com. So anyone who wants more info, you can go there. If you're catching the show later and it's not near the top of the list, just go to the mightyparenting.com podcast page, which is in the menu, pick podcast, and then there's a search box. And you just put Elvin Gonzalez in there, and you will come up with this episode. So Elvin, I appreciate you coming and joining us today. I know you're incredibly busy. I see you running all over town doing things. And so your insights were very helpful and also, as I said, very hopeful. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you. And good luck to all the parents out there that are listening, and keep doing a good job. And the best thing we can do as parents is really be there for our kids and be actively involved in their life. Thank you.
And all my mighty parents, thank you for being here and for sharing the podcast with friends and giving ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player. We appreciate all you guys are doing to support us and each other. If you're here listening, remember that you are a mighty parent, and I'll see you next week.